Did Plato, like, one explanation you would have to give that Plato simply copied the passage from
the Spartan troubles, or the troubles which the Spartans got with their helots.
Yeah.
But if they are judicious in that, they can last very long and can be a fraud to society. So that's the kind of thing we have in mind. Is it the same as what Scipio meant? That's your question. And I'm sure that is not the case. Because for Scipio, while he might admit this sad necessity, the justification would consist, what is that state going to do with the power which is just acquired and which was not in all these all cases justly acquired? And from Philo's previous point of view, this question would not come up, or from Canada. That I think is the point. In other words, you see, what will they do with that power? And will they really be conscientious so that they will resort to such extreme measures only in case of absolute necessity, or will this become a kind of common practice which then is bound to have also a terrible political effect? It is really a political difference which cannot be reduced to simple rules, but to the spirit of a society which is, consists of itself merely in terms of the self-preservation of individuals, collective selfishness coming from that, and not caring, not a dedication of the society as a whole to an idea in modern language. That I think is what Scipio means, and what surely Plato and Aristotle meant, and Cicero, and the absence of such dedication. That I think would be the difference. You see, you have then here.
We have to, prior to a real proof, we have to believe Socrates. We don't know Hippocrates, but Socrates knew him, and Socrates said he's politically ambitious. And Socrates said he's courageous.
Yeah.
So I ask whether these things, especially the assertion regarding Hippocrates' courage, will not break down after a more profound study of what courage is, that's not a matter. But in a superficial sense, he's courageous.
But if he is courageous in that superficial sense, then he is like the other people of his grown courage.
Yeah, but of course here the question is disregarded, and I think there are various levels, whether you do not also need some intelligence in addition to courage in order to learn something. This question is wholly abstracted from this dialogue. There is an allusion to it when Socrates speaks about his nature, and he speaks to Protagoras about Hippocrates' nature. We have discussed it at that time. He only says what people think about his nature, not what his nature truly is.
It encourages wisdom that either Socrates doesn't need the courage
of teaching,
or else
he is not courageous.
Not really courageous.
Yeah.
Now, suppose he had this wrong kind of courage.
If this proves to be not courage, then it is no good. If this quality, if this quality only looks like courage but isn't courage, it's no good. We don't know. It may prevent it, in for all we know, prior to investigation. Yes.
And Protagoras' art is no longer a political art. It has something to do with his enlightenment, which might well be reduced to rhetoric.
Yeah, well, rhetoric is eminently political. But
not the political art.
But I would, the first part of your statement is very good and very important. In the whole process of the Protagoras, Sugata not only debunks Protagoras, yeah, and shows that he is not as clever and admirable as people think, but which is very equally important, he debunks this notion of the political art. The art which will come out in the sequel, because Sugata will make a counter proposal in the sequel to Protagoras of what the sophist should do. This art is no longer the political art. So that is a twofold debunking. And at the beginning of that is Protagoras' statement regarding courage here, from which we must be, but it takes some time. Now let us continue. How Sugata's established. Mr. Langton?
Stop, I said. I should like to investigate that. When you speak of courageous men, do you mean the confident or something else? Yes, he said, I mean the aggressive, ready to go at that which most people are afraid to approach. In the next place, you would affirm virtue to be a good thing, of which good thing you assert yourself to be a teacher.
Oh, no. Noble.
A noble thing.
No, he speaks always of noble in this connection here. Yeah. That good is, what we call the moral was called by the Greeks the noble and just. You know, the good is not in itself a moral criterion. Good is useful also. What we call the moral is the just and the noble. The just is what is our duty, we say. The noble what is beyond the call of duty. What is particularly praiseworthy. The noble in Latin honesto, which of course has undergone all kinds of changes of meaning, the honest. But which is a much broader meaning in original and original Latin. Yes? No, he says, most noble unless I am mad. Yes? Now, what about, we have had a reference to the question of madness in Perina 23a to b. A certain statement, true statement, would never be made by people who are not mad. So this does not mean it would be mad to make the statement, but it's not necessarily untrue, according to Protagoras' own interpretation of what madness is. But go on.
And is it partly noble and partly base, I said, or wholly noble? Wholly noble and in the highest degree. Tell me then, who are they who have confidence when diving into a well? I should say, divers. And the reason of this is that they have knowledge. Yes, that is the reason. And who have confidence when fighting on horseback? The skilled horsemen or the unskilled? The skilled. And who, when fighting with light shields? The peltasts or the non-peltasts? The peltasts. And that is true of all other cases, he said, if that is your point. Those who have knowledge are more confident than those who have no knowledge, and they are more confident after they have learned than before. And have you not seen persons utterly ignorant, I said, of these things, and yet confident about them? Yes, he said, I have seen such persons far too confident. And are not these confident persons also courageous? In that case, he replied, courage would be a base thing, for the men of whom we are speaking are surely madmen. Then, what do you mean when you speak of the courageous? Do you not mean that they are confident? Yes, he said, but that statement I hear. And those, I said, who are thus confident without knowledge are really not courageous, mad. And in the former case, on the other hand, those who are the wisest are also most confident, and being most confident are most courageous. According to this argument also, wisdom would be current.
No. It says, what is that? The nerve of the onion. There are two kinds of conflict. A noble and a base. The noble we call courage, and the base we call madness. Noble confidence, this kind of noble confidence is the courage. But what is the difference between noble confidence and ignorance? Answer, that it is based on knowledge. Hence, courage, noble confidence, is knowledge or wisdom. That's so kind of argument. Now, what, I mean, this, let us not consider now what Protagoras says later. Protagoras will give a critical analysis of this argument. But what would be our reaction to this argument?
I think it depends on what the knowledge is of. You might say that in this case of these divers, merely to know that you can get away with it is not what we call courage. But to know that you must do a thing, even though there's very little chance of your coming through, that is an ingredient in true military courage.
Yeah, well, now let us try to be a bit more precise. Now, those who face something of which they know that it is not dangerous, are they courageous? If someone is not afraid of a harmless fly, surely not. By courage we understand something like standing up to dangerous things. For example, to the tyrant and all his might. That would be a courageous man. Now, is it of the essence of the wise man to do this, to stand up to the tyrant and all his might? According to Simonides in 346b, the wise man may adjust himself. Only the wise man who opposes the tyrant's injustice needs courage. So the relation of wisdom and courage is ambiguous. And this surely implies that wisdom is not identical with courage. The argument, in other words, has somehow a defect. Aristotle develops this at great length in the third book of the Ethics when he speaks of courage and shows that this professional courage is not true courage. But it's simply because you trust your competence. You do not face the danger as such. That is the point. Yes?
Would you say that Socrates, in every one of his actions which is concerned with wisdom, is also displaying courage? Because in always going deeper into and getting involved with other people for wisdom, there is always the unknown. He doesn't know what is going to happen to him because he is getting involved with them.
Yeah, well, I suppose so. But the question is, can any man be simply courageous? At the end of the Phaedo, the praise of Socrates, does any one of you have the Phaedo here? Phaedo here? Because I don't remember it by heart. Well, Socrates is said to be at the same time that he was the best of, if I remember that, the best, the wise one of his contemporaries, not simple. Because if all virtue is wisdom, and man cannot be wise, but only a seeker for wisdom, philosopher, then of course no man can be simply virtuous. And therefore, I hesitate to answer your question. In the ordinary sense, he surely was very correct.
Well, since
every man has to be a seeker for wisdom.
For both the men of the time to know.
I see. Yeah. He was the wisest and justest and best. The cult is not even mentioned. In the list of Socrates' virtues, the two lists which Xenophon makes, cult is not mentioned. That is a long question. Because it is cult is an ambiguous virtue. Yes.
If every man has to be a seeker for wisdom and can never be wise or be good, doesn't this always involve going beyond yourself and looking for something more? And isn't this what courage is?
All right, then you understand courage in an unusual way, but you surely made one mistake. Plato doesn't say also that every man must seek for wisdom. Some can't, and if they would try, it would really be a very sorry spectrum. Yes.
I think in the Phaedo, Socrates says that his life, or all life, is a preparation for dying.
Yes. But who are the ones who prepare themselves for death, according to Socrates?
Only wise.
Philosophers. You see, they are back where we started. Now, this gentleman from the new school in the last row, I forgot your name.
Oh, yes. The implication here is that fear is predicated of ignorance, and if you get knowledge, then fear tends to dissipate itself.
Yes.
And with the lack of fear, which comes through knowledge, you also have confidence, and with the confidence, you have courage.
But the question is this what you mean by courage? The kind of confidence coming from knowledge, at least from this kind of professional knowledge. Then you have to put it on a broader basis and say courage comes from the awareness that death is no evil. On the inside, that death is no evil. And that is a long story. But that is not the kind of knowledge which the horsemen or the divers as such have. They may have it, but they do not have it as such. But then I suggest that we turn to Protagoras, the criticism of Socrates' art, okay? Which comes in the sequel. It would be good if it could finish there.
Nay, Socrates, he replied, you are mistaken in your remembrance of what I said and answered to. When you asked me, I certainly did say that the courageous are the confident, but I would never ask whether the confident are the courageous. If you had asked me, I should have answered, not all of them. And when I did answer, namely that the courageous are confident, you have not proved to be false.
Let us first see. What is Protagoras? Here you see first, he's now quite sure of himself. He is no longer nervous. And this may be due to Socrates' treatment. You know, when Socrates said to him, you may have made your earlier statements not because you believe them, but in order to test them. Now, his diagnosis of the defect of Socrates' reasoning. First, Socrates had inferred from the courageous are confident that the confident are courageous. Yeah. Did Socrates do that? I don't believe so. Certain phrases could have misled Protagoras into thinking that, but this surely Socrates made it perfectly clear. Confidence is the genus of which courage and madness, let's say, are species. Socrates did not make this mistake. But he gives now another diagnosis in the sequel. Yes?
Next, you proceeded to show that those who have no past knowledge are more confident than they were before they had knowledge, and more confident than others who have no knowledge, and were then led on to think that courage is the same as wisdom. But in this way of arguing, you might come to imagine that strength is wisdom. You might begin by asking whether the strong are able, but I should say yes. And then whether those who know how to...
Let us rather say powerful, as to say that the strength and strong are powerful.
Powerful. And I should say yes. And then whether those who know how to wrestle are not more able to wrestle than those who do not know how to wrestle, and more powerful after than before they had learned. And I should assent. And when I had admitted this, you might use my admissions in such a way as to prove that upon my view, wisdom is strength. Whereas in that case, I could not have admitted any more than in the other that the powerful are strong, although I have admitted that the strong are powerful. For there is a difference between the power and strength.
Yeah, now let us stop here for a moment. Now this analysis runs like this. Socrates had inferred from the fact that the knowers are more courageous than the non-knowers that courage is knowledge. Socrates had done this. But why is this inference wrong? According to Protagoras, Socrates' inference is like this. The strong are powerful. The knowers are powerful. Hence, strength is identical with knowledge. But by admitting that the strong are powerful, one does not admit that all powerful are strong. Or to take a simple example of this fallacy which Protagoras attributes to Socrates, all geese are animals. All zebras are animals. Ergo, all geese are zebras. But Socrates did not commit, whatever he did not commit this kind of blunder. Now, Protagoras has not really seen what the problem here is. Now, yes, now let us follow this. That is, Socrates did not make this simple blunder, that's clear. Whatever was wrong. Now then, see how Protagoras goes on from here.
The former, that is power, is given by knowledge as well as by madness or rage.
Now, but one moment, let me see the definition. Power and strength are not the same. The one comes, namely the power comes both from knowledge, and from madness as well as spiritedness, yes?
And spiritedness. But strength comes from nature and a healthy state of the body.
Good food, from good feeding of the body, So, power comes from knowledge and from madness as well as spiritedness. Strength comes from nature and good feeding of the body. In other words, so far from being identical, power and strength have absolutely nothing in common. He goes to the other extreme in order to prevent Socrates' false extreme, namely the simple identification. And now the application is crucial to our case.
And in like manner, I say of confidence and courage that they are not the same. And I argue that the courageous are confident, but not all the confident courageous. For confidence may be given to men by art, and also like
art in the same sense as science here, or knowledge. But he used the word Krishna indeed. Yes?
Like power, by madness and rage. But courage comes to them from nature and good nurture of the soul.
Of the soul, yes. Now, the statement is clear. Now, if we take it very literally, it means that courage is not a kind of confidence, just as strength is not a kind of power. But Protagoras would run from the frying pan into fire in order to prevent the identification of wisdom and courage, or of confidence and courage. He denies that they have anything in common. But more important is the following thing. Courage comes from nature and good feeding of the soul. But what is the food for the soul?
Teaching.
Srimad 13c, where Socrates explains it through Hippocrates. Hence, courage comes from knowledge of properly gifted people, from the education of properly gifted people. But what about wisdom? Does wisdom not come from exactly the same thing? Hence, Protagoras proves unwittingly what he hates to prove, namely that courage is wisdom. But perhaps Protagoras makes a distinction between good feeding of the soul and learning or teaching, for all we know. Then, of course, courage would not be the same as wisdom. Wisdom would have nothing to do with good feeding of the soul, i.e. with the education which he, Protagoras, conveys. That could be that this is not wisdom at all, what he teaches these young ambitious Athenians is not wisdom. But does he even teach courage? We have observed his silence on courage in his long speech, where he mentioned only justice, piety, and moderation. These three virtues, which he called at that time political virtues, do not come from nature, because everyone has them, but they come in a manner from good feeding of the soul. Wisdom comes from nature, but not from good feeding of the soul. And then, if this is so, courage would occupy a position in between political virtue, in Protagoras' sense, and wisdom. Yet this is, of course, untenable, because political virtue must include, whether Protagoras has admitted it or not, must include courage, because the political art necessarily includes the art of war, as Protagoras states in his long speech, 326. There is, you see, one thing is clear, the final statement here, the end of this speech, and the statement in 349d6-8, they contradict each other. Protagoras seems to be quite confused regarding this virtue of manliness or courage. And we have to turn to that next time. Let us only read the very beginning of the next statement.
I said, you would admit, Protagoras, that some men live well and others ill.
Yeah, now let us stop here. Now, Protagoras has, in his view, defeated Socrates' attempt to prove that wisdom is identical with courage. And he has made quite a long speech, as you have seen. But Socrates acts very differently than he did on that former occasion when Protagoras made his long speech in 34-35. Why did he act, or he act differently now? In that former occasion, in 334c6-7, after he had made the long speech, remember, something is different is good for the roots of a tree and for the leaf, for the leaves and all this kind of thing. When he had said this, those present shouted aloud how well he spoke, and then Sukadev begins with the litigation. Now here we see no shouting, wonderful speech, no praise of Sukadev. How come? Why do the others not acclaim Protagoras anymore? Well, a simple explanation would be that they have learned a lesson. Last time they acclaimed, Sukadev threatened to finish all of them. In other words, they aren't, even the others, not only Protagoras, are now in awe of Sukadev. Not only Protagoras, but the audience too is shaped. Yes. Now we leave it, we must leave it at this point, and we will continue here. I'm sorry, I cannot stay here for a second.
Now, in other words, that he refers here to criticism of Polybius, the Greek, imbued with Greek thought of education, of the Roman students. Because the emphasis on an education, on what the Greeks called education paideia, which in this way was absent from Rome. And what is the point which he makes here in this major speaker? So to repeat, the end of civil society is according to Cicero exactly the same as according to Plato and Aristotle. But there could very well be important differences in secondary regarding the means. And one seems to concern the status of education, the education of the boys. Yeah? And here there were entirely different notions in Greece than in Rome. And what is the point he makes here, in particular? Perhaps you read finish paragraph 4, which you began.
Say nothing of the alien conceived. Among whom love is actually given free reign in relation to free men. The Spartans themselves, who give every human to love that young men accept that of actual violence, protect only by a very thin law from one exception. For, provided only the close being in his love, they allow embrace and the sharing of the bed. I see clearly, Scipio, that in regard to the Greek systems of training which you criticize, you prefer to attack the most famous state rather than your beloved place, whom you did.
No, let's stop here. Now, you see that, in order to what the layer says is this, you take issue with the great easygoing attitude to homosexuality, and yet you are such an admirer of Plato. Yeah? Plato, who has made quite a few concessions, as you know, in the Republic. Now, what about Plato then, indeed? At the end of paragraph 5, there is a remark which apparently was made by Scipio also. At the end of paragraph 5,
in the same way, Plato says, before we're out of the city, he invents buying him off the reed, anointing
him
with
virtue. Yeah, of course. I don't know whether whether he did not mean to say, I teach you, throw out Plato from my perfect career in the same way that Plato threw out Homer from his. That is, of course, not possible. He decided to get a judgment as I finished. But what is the significance of this statement? Now let me see, there are some others which we have to take together. You see, in the sequel, that was also referred that there should be, in Greece, there was, in the aristocratic setting, an office of the supervisor of women. In Rome, that was understood to be the business of the husband, ultimately chargeable by the censor, the public official, but there was not, did not this office exist of some outstanding citizen who watched the conduct of women.
And there are some other references to such differences. And the very high praise of conjugal chastity, which is also not a new edition, but which is in a letter of Augustine printed in the good edition of the original of Latin origin. Now seems to have come out here in this section is this. The stern virtue of the Roman against Greek laxity. One can, I think, safely say that this was here a theme. Now the question is, what is the fundamental significance of this criticism? Let me explain this question. We have been told at the beginning that we presented to the presentation of the best regime. And this best regime is the Roman regime. And its superiority to all the other regimes was explained by the fact that it was not the product of a single wise man, but of a sequence of wise men throughout the ages. Yeah? Now, here Cicero explicitly differs from Plato and Aristotle. Now, the question is whether the individual point of criticism he makes later on has anything whatever to do with this explicit fundamental deviation, one wise man or the series of wise men in the preceding age. Now, what about this point? Is there any connection, any necessary connection between the greater severity of Roman sexual morality, for example, in the good times, than that of the Greeks? I mean, this is something which is essentially related to the fact that in Rome there was a sequel of wise men and not merely a single wise legislator at the beginning. I do not believe there is any principle involved here. This is a question, an important question, but a question of the second order, of the proper means. Whether these Roman institutions, they are not more conducive to that virtue which Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero had equally in mind. There's no fundamental sense. It's a question regarding the proper means. Or does anyone believe that Cicero means more? You know, according to the myth in which we are now brought up, there was once the Greek culture, and then there was the Roman culture, each with a unique spirit of its own, and therefore when philosophy migrated from Greece to Rome, philosophy altered its character radically. A Roman philosopher could not possibly be a Greek in the decisive respect with Greek philosophy. And I think there is no reason whatever to assume that instead of Cicero, I mean, as Laelius question says, you are Plato to Cicero. Cicero is the Platonist who may deviate from Plato in quite a few specific points, you know, like matrimonial law or whatever the issue may be. You see also another point which I mentioned in passing in paragraph 7, when he says, where is that? On page 237, the last speech in paragraph 7. So it is there.
In a system of high ranking, a man of high reputation, I judge flattery, ingratiation,
The Latin word for canvassing is ambitio, ambition. That is the original meaning. Ambitio means to go around, to going around and begging for votes. Yeah? That's a strange origin of this term. But it is still intelligible because ambitious people still do it. Now that is an important point, and I remember I had in a former class a discussion where we read a passage in Aristotle's Politics where Aristotle expressed the same opinion that a self-respecting man would never run for office, and it was suggested that this shows what babe in the woods, the classics there, you know, don't
element of the political trade, that of course your answer still don't exist. But what do you say about the syllogism? It is worth considering, because the fact that we take it for granted may show a naivete on our part, at least the fact that we have not thought about something about which people in other times thought. I mean, how can this be understood? That running for office, and therefore also canvassing, was regarded as improper. I would raise this question, are there still, in our experience, cases where we agree with the classification?
Well, we make a distinction commonly between a person who is a mere party hat from semi-financial vote,
yeah,
and things like this. I think in this sense we can still condemn this type of thing between a man and this, and a man who has some virtue about him that makes him fit for the office of what he's running, but the exigency of the man that he belongs in.
Yeah, but still, we are speaking now, surely, that is clear. And therefore, sometimes we make a distinction between the statesman and the politician. As though the President Truman, I forgot his study, what did he say? What the difference is?
He said
he's referred to the politician. No, but he gave a definition of the statesman.
Politician, politician,
death. Yeah, something of the sort. Yeah. And this definition is not wholly grounded, but precisely because today, even people who are generally regarded as not party hats do run for office. Yeah, and one gets the impression those who will run only if forced to do create a situation in which they are forced to other people to run. But still, I mean, I always take a similar example of what is happening in a department. It is still regarded, and not only on the basis of some old-fashioned taboos, but on the basis of very concrete experience, that if someone is eager to become the department chairman, yeah, you know, that is usually looked at scandal. Yeah? That simply one doesn't do. I mean, sometimes the man may really be compelled because everyone says you are the only one who can defend this department against administration, and this kind of thing, that is clear, and then one could say security. But with men who are eager and trying to enlist votes in this kind of thing, that is still regarded as not the right thing to do. What I want to say is this, perhaps the polis or civil society, as it was understood by Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero, had something important in common with what we know only in fairly small associations. They like departments. And it's from this point of view something entirely different from the modern state. Do you want to say that?
Very much like society, religious society, such as the election of Pope.
Yeah. Now here's another theory is simply to suppose that there is a glaring contrast between the function and the means by which it works. Yeah, but that was, I think, also true not in part in the ancient cities, where they are not so perfect as we know. But when Ben and I and Cicero write about the best societies, they think, of course, in terms of what one could and should reasonably wish. What they mean is they have no delusion about what is likely to happen. But it would be better, yeah, if they're so impossible to life. And there is no intrinsic impossibility. Yeah. There's no intrinsic impossibility that there might be men who deserve to rule, who yet acquire ruling functions without liking it, without running for it, without canvassing. There's no intrinsic impossibility. Yeah.
One thing, though, is there any contradiction about planning to spend one's life in politics and yet at the same time not seeking political office? So it's a matter of this.
duty for the desire for having his hands in the pie. Yeah? And the what we usually do, I believe, is to say, to make a distinction between those who, of whom reasonable men would wish that they would be elected, yeah? Regardless of whether they also like to be elected or not. Yeah? You know, that is, I think, sufficient for most practical service. But the question, the moral question implied, is not a senseless question. And I think it would contribute to a better understanding of the modern state if one would think about these differences, that today no one would find anything wrong with canvassing, you know? And the fundamental change which has occurred, by virtue of which this whole question has disappeared. In this respect, we may very well have become cruder than former generations of men there. Now then we come to this very interesting discussion in the same context, again a criticism of Greek regarding poetry. And not everything which is known to us about that of Cicero is printed in the edition. For example, in Seneca's letters, the following passage occurs. Cicero says that even if his lifetime were doubled, he would not have the time for reading lyrical poetry. And especially the criticism of comedy and also later on of rhetoric. How did you try to account for that, Mr. Faulkner, of the criticism of poetry? In the first place, does this bespeak a fundamental difference between Cicero and Plato and Aristotle?
I think it's
very
good
to play. No, he makes here one special point regarding the ridiculing of politically leading figures of statesmen by comic poets, and he approves of the Roman legislation which forbade it. Yeah? But there are also certain limitations of that even in Athens. But surely in Athens it's very much at all. So there is again no fundamental difference, it seems to me. The point is only this, that we don't know of course whether this stems from the Cicero's Republic, but in other ancient writer records that Cicero said that comedy is an imitation of life, a mirror of custom, an image of truth, which does not quite drive this severe remark against comedy made here. And you can also take the other point, which is the criticism of rhetoric. After all, Cicero was one of the most famous and greatest orators who ever lived. This creates also a problem. You know, whether here in this statement of what would be the highest moral requirement of a society, Cicero does not condemn quite a few things of which he knew that they would be incompatible, indispensable for a more civilized society. Which is fundamentally the same question as that of political and theoretical life. And same difficulty, of course, exists also in Plato. Now, as for the fifth book, we have here in this case the beginning of the fifth book, and apparently the first, the third, and the fifth book, it's always two books for one day of the conversation. And the first and third and fifth book always began with introductions by Cicero before the conversation proper begins. Now, here is a statement which is of some importance for the understanding of some details of the book, at any rate. If you put in paragraph 2, which is on page 2 and 45. Paragraph 2.
Our poets seem to have the same reward, so breaking truth, and marvel.
a reflection about the presence, Cicero's presence, and Cicero living in the decay, the bit of the decay of the Roman Republic, the first century. And in a way, that is, of course, the starting point of Cicero's whole work. And one is tempted by such things, of course, and to succumb to that temptation is characteristic of much of present politics, simply to understand the work on the Republic as a pamphlet written with a view to the situation prevailing in Cicero's time. That goes too far. I mean, Cicero really tried to present the true principles of political life for all time. Yes?
Don't you feel that it is his concern with the state of Rome, which causes the difference between the colonies, the difference between Plato? He feels the need to provide an inducement, if you will, to political virtue, to political, to active political life.
Yes.
And that this causes him in a number of ways. And I tried to outline some of them.
Yes. I don't believe that this question, the same question,
of how the subject of the Roman Empire felt about Rome has been properly studied. I get the impression from Plutarch that the Greeks said that they didn't like it at all. And we are the offspring of liberal societies in which everyone can say more or less everything he thinks, and we take it for granted that this was always the case. I'm by no means sure whether a subject of the Roman Empire could publicly attack the Roman system. I have the feeling that this explains to a certain extent the whole work of Plutarch, I mean this attempt to contrast Roman and Greek, you know, that the way in a parallel biography, in each case a Roman and a Greek. Now, and in quite a few of these parallel articles, I have read a bit more carefully, the superiority of the Greek question appears quite obviously when you read. But when Plutarch sums up at the end, he speaks only of the things which are equally traceable in both cases. For example, if you read the Marcellus story, in which Marcellus was the conqueror of Syracuse and the indirectly responsible for the death of Archimedes, Epaminondas is a Greek, the corresponding Greek. And I think if you read the two lives of the period, it is quite natural. Now, Cicero was a Roman, and a patriotic Roman, there's no question about it, but he was deeply impressed by the greatness of Greek wisdom. And he was aware of the fact that it created a resistance on the basis of the imperial nation, you know, Rome. You cannot compare the Romans in this respect to the English, you know, a modern nation where all these things differ, you know. This kind of resistance in modern times is not as profound. They were a much more customary and polar. Now how did we come to that? How did we come to this question of the... Now philosophy, today philosophy is no longer a problem. Everywhere you find departments of philosophy, and that is much as much as a matter of routine as the police and the collection of garbage and family dancers and what have you. There is no problem. But that was not so in former times. Philosophy appeared as a very strange thing. And there is plenty of evidence of that in Greek history. And to repeat, when philosophy migrated to other cultures or nations, it had the additional blemish of being foreign or alien. And Cicero found that a study of Lucretius, a contemporary of Cicero, the Epicurean poet, would also show this. It begins, Lucretius' poem begins as a Roman poem, with a great emphasis, Roman, a Roman addressing Roman. And only later on does the greatness of Greek thought, the model for the Greek, comes into the open. I do not know at the moment how we came to this particular question, but I think it is not an impertinent remark anyway. Or do you remember how we came to that?
Yes, I do.
Cicero was under a quasi obligation to emphasize the Romanism of his doctrine. I think you'll find, of course, there is always all the praise of Greece which occurs in introductions to philosophic writings has also this apologetic undertone. The case for the introduction of Rome of Greek letters must be made. It's not a foregone conclusion. In
Yeah, and Scipio, of course, is the greatest Roman authority for the sensibility of devoting oneself to the letters. Now let us turn to paragraph 5, it's a long speech of Cicero, of Scipio.
The field superintendent then knows the nature of the land. The household superintendent knows how to read and write. And both are interested in the practical utility of their knowledge, rather than in the pleasure they take in its possession. In the same way then, the governing statesman abroad, and should have taken the pains, become familiar with justice and law, and should have examined their origin. But he should not allow his time constantly to be taken up with contemplation, or by reading and writing on the subject. For he must be able, as we may say, to act as both field superintendent and household superintendent of the commonwealth. He must be fully conversant with justice in its highest aspect, for without that no one can be just. And he must not be ignorant of the civil law, but his knowledge of it should be like the pilot's knowledge of a star, or a physician's knowledge of physics. For each uses his knowledge of his own eyes, but does not allow it to keep him in his own special duties.
Yes, you see. That has something to do with the old question of theory and practice of the philosophic or political life, which we met at the beginning and which we meet again. You see here, he must have knowledge that he must be perfectly experienced in the highest right, just better than said it, not the highest aspect of it, the highest right, and he must be not inexperienced of civil life. You see the difference. I mean, that which he has to know to the highest degree is the highest right. As for merely civil law, he must be familiar with it, but not in the superlative to the other. Now, the point which he made, where the emphasis is here, is this. He must have studied that, even in order to know the civil law as to read and write. But still more so, for understanding that summum jus, that highest right, which of course is what the philosophers teach, not the Roman law. Civil law, Roman order, much higher law.